Well, first of all, thanks to the organisers of this programme for giving me the chance to spend some weeks here, which have been fantastically interesting and enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to my return in end of May. So, thanks also for the opportunity to give a talk here, and thanks to everyone who came at a relatively early hour. There'll be several people who have seen the talk several times in the last few weeks, and a couple of collaborators who know it all anyway, but hopefully it'll be of interest to a group of people in the audience. So it's joint work with Victor Dominguez, who's a young guy, a colleague of mine, visited me several times. He's in Pamplona in the University of Navarra, the public University of Navarra, and Valery Smyslev, who's here in the audience. And the talk will concentrate on the numerical analysis of the plane wave scattering problem. And I present a method which is valid in three dimensions and two dimensions, and I'll present the analysis in two dimensions. So the problem is an incident plane wave with frequency k and unit direction d hat is incident on an obstacle here drawn as a smooth convex obstacle. And the problem is to compute the scattered wave, us. And the scattered wave, so omega primed is the exterior domain, and the scattered wave satisfies the potential for the scattered wave, US, satisfies the Helmholtz equation in the exterior domain. And the problem has to have a boundary condition on the boundary of the scatterer gamma. So, for example, Dirichlet condition means that the total wave, U incident, UI plus US, vanishes. So US equals minus UI on the boundary. That's the sound soft boundary condition, which we'll concentrate on in this talk. Other boundary conditions, sound hard boundary condition, would involve a vanishing Neumann boundary condition. Or you could have an impedance boundary condition, which is links the normal derivative, and so links the Neumann data and the Dirichlet data. And a radiation condition in the far field to ensure uniqueness. And the problem is, as many of us are interested in this program, to generate robust methods as k goes to infinity. So this is a completely trivial slide, one I had for an earlier talk, but I've left it in. The engineering rule of thumb for problems with oscillatory solutions is 5 to 10 grid points per wavelength. So here's a simple wave with four wavelengths, and this is the approximation by interpolation using 1 degree of freedom per wavelength sitting here, 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 and here. If you increase that to 2 degrees of freedom per wavelength, you get no benefit whatsoever, because the degrees of freedom again are sitting along these intersection points. And only when you have 3 degrees of freedom and more do you start to get something that looks like a wave, and still not a particularly good approximation. So in terms of interpolation error, if we think about piecewise linear interpolation to the oscillatory solution U, then trivially order h squared times the second derivative of U. And in this situation, the second derivative grows like k squared. So every time you bump up the order of the method, you bump up the number of derivatives, and you end up getting some power of hk. So a trivial remark for everybody here, but nevertheless important. The mesh diameter must go to zero, like the inverse of k, the wave number. And so if you were working in three-dimensional problems, then the degrees of freedom grow like k cubed. if you're doing boundary elements for a three-dimensional problem and working on a two-dimensional surface, then the number of degrees of freedom will grow like k squared for standard piecewise polynomial methods. So here's a picture from a PhD thesis from Brunel University of an outdoor sound barrier. And in this case, if you were modeling that by a boundary integral equation, then you would have an integral equation over this two-dimensional surface. So it's a long obstacle if you were, for example, modeling sound acoustic waves in an acoustic field in a street. Then the sort of dimensions would be that you would have to model might be, say, 100 meters by 10 meters. And in that case, you have to ask what is the wavelength and then how many degrees of freedom. So the wavelength depends on what the correct frequency should be for such problems. And so at the top end of the noise scale for city streets, about 5,000 hertz is the right frequency. And when you do the calculation and figure out the number of degrees of freedom that you would need to do a conventional boundary element simulation of this problem, then you're looking at the order of 10 to the 7 unknowns. So this would mean that you would have a dense matrix with 10 to the 7 unknowns, which is just about on the boundary of what's possible, it would be far beyond the boundary of what's possible if you write down the matrix exactly. But it's just about on the boundary of what's possible with the supercomputer with a fast multipole data sparse representation of the matrix. Nevertheless, of course, you can imagine more complicated structures. And when we were at the meeting in London a couple of weeks ago, engineers were modeling whole cities or combinations of streets and buildings that are far beyond what I've described here. And the number of degrees of freedom will grow. That should be k to the power of the dimension minus 1 for boundary elements. So the aim of the research is to have a decreasing error as n increases. N is the number of degrees of freedom. And that this should happen independent of k. And I suppose from our point of view, the holy grail would be an error bounded in some norm in terms of some power of the 1 over the number of degrees of freedom. I mean, in a exponentially convergent method, then this would be true for all n. So that would be terrific if you could manage that. But the important thing is that we would like this constant to be as independent of k as possible. But modestly growing with k, I mean, independent of k would be great. Going to 0 as k increases would be even better. But most of the methods will have some modest growth of k here, which will then be cancelled out by the fact that you have exponential convergence with respect to the numbers of degrees of freedom. And the method is, as always, to identify explicitly the rapidly oscillating part of the solution and approximate only the slowly varying remainder. So the plan of the talk is to revise the combined potential formulation for this problem and discuss the continuity and coercivity properties of the operator and what we've so far proved about that. And then develop a hybrid asymptotic numerical ansatz based on geometric optics approximation. This leads you to a slow variable which you isolate from the oscillations, which you then approximate. And in order to do the rigorous numerical analysis, you need estimates for the derivatives of the slow variable. So this is somehow a non-trivial task which needs to build in the known. You get your inspiration from the asymptotics literature. From that, we can then get error estimates for the Galerkin method. And I'll describe some numerical experiments. And at the end, I'll come to the problem of oscillatory integration for the implementation. So actually, if you talk to your friends in asymptotics and you say, well, I'm interested in solving this wave scattering problem in the high frequency, they'll say, well, what are you worried about? This was all done in the 60s and 70s. Just look in the right literature. Look in the works of Fock and Buslaev and Joe Keller and so on. And there you find formulae which are valid as the frequency tends to infinity. But in the case, of course, in numerical methods, I mean, you want to solve the problem for high k. You don't necessarily want a formula which then itself is in complicated special function form. As a numerical method, it's not necessarily appropriate. And so it's actually only relatively recently that numerical analysts started combining these asymptotic ideas with numerical methods to produce what I would say were more practical methods. And the idea is to have a method which works for a broad range of frequencies, including medium frequency, the resonance region, up to high frequency. So I think the Trailblazer, although it's they're difficult papers to get hold of because none of them were published in standard journals. They're conference proceedings, and well, there's a small announcement in Compte Rendu in 94 by Nedelec's group, where they first of all presented a Galerkin method based on these ideas. And then there was a gap of maybe 10 years until the work of Oscar Bruno and co. in the beginning of this century, so around the 2001 to 2004, and there are some papers around 2004. And then there's recent work of Simon Chander-Weil's group in Reading, and work from Leuven by Dan Huybrechts and Stefan van de Valle. So these are four important papers showing recent interest in this problem. My talk is going to be based on this paper, which will soon appear in Numerische Mathematik. So for the purpose of the presentation here, I'm now going to concentrate on the Dirichlet problem. So the total wave is the sum of the incident and the scattered wave. So I've changed the font. This was capital I before. U incident plus U scattered. And then, using Green's identity, you can write the scattered wave in terms of a boundary integral. So here, this is the fundamental solution of the Helmholtz equation in two dimensions, the Hankel function, first kind of order zero, depends on the distance between the observation point and the integration point and the frequency, so a highly oscillatory kernel. And V here is the density of the integral operator, which is the normal derivative of the total wave. And this integral is over the boundary, and this is a reconstruction formula for the solution, the scattered wave, everywhere in the exterior domain. So this is just an application of Green's identity. And V here, if we know V on the boundary, we know the scattered wave everywhere. And then you can let the observation point tend to the boundary, and then you get an integral equation for V in term, so U, the scattered wave is minus the incident wave on the boundary for a Dirichlet problem. So this gives us an integral equation for V on the boundary, which we could solve for V. But unfortunately, this integral equation has spurious frequencies. So Ralph Hipmeyer talked about this in some detail. So you don't use just this integral equation. So this thing equals minus UI. So that's exactly this term and this term in this formulation. What you do is you take that integral equation coming from here, multiply by a coupling parameter I eta, and then you take an analogous equation for the normal derivative of this quantity. And that's this operator called D, which is the adjoint of the double layer operator for those who have worked in this area. It's another integral operator involving the normal derivative of the Hankel function. And this operator has a jump discontinuity as you tend to the boundary. So when you differentiate that and then go to the boundary, you get a half identity coming out from the jump discontinuity. You combine, and this gives you the normal derivative of the incident wave on the right-hand side. You combine those two, and you get this so-called combined potential, which is sometimes called Brackhage and Werner and sometimes called Burton-Miller. But And it's also related to a formulation from Panitch in the Soviet Union literature from the 60s. The problem is that V is highly oscillatory. But the nice thing is that it's a physical quantity. It's the normal derivative of the total wave. And so there are asymptotic results about the behavior of this V. So here's the formulation. Rk of V equals Fk. Everything depends on K. The problem is uniquely solvable for all coupling parameters eta. And in a sense that I'll try to explain, it's natural to take eta to be of order K. And roughly speaking, that's because when we look at the dependence of these two operators on K, they're both of the same order, if you make that choice. So the idea is to write this equation in weak form. Okay, and so here I'm working in the space L2. And as Ralph pointed out, there are difficulties with L2 if you have Lipschitz, if you only have Lipschitz continuity for the obstacle. But here I'm thinking not about those difficult geometrical details in the boundary. So I'm going to work in L2. The problem is well posed in L2 in this case. Okay, and then the Galerkin method is just doing this variational formulation in some finite dimensional space. And the wonderful thing about the Galerkin method is that there's a completely general error analysis. So we don't need to say anything about this space except that it's a subspace of L2. And then, provided the original formulation is coercive and continuous, then you have an error estimate for the error in terms of the best possible approximation of the solution from the finite element, from the finite dimensional space. And the constant of proportionality is the ratio of continuity constant to coercivity constant. So the talk is sort of, I'll drone on for a while about this constant here, and then I'll drone on about this. Okay, so there are the two things will be necessary for the error analysis. So the first thing is the coercivity and continuity. So this is not so easy, and the reason is that if you remember, the parameter k appeared in the integral operator inside the kernel function. So this is a horrible nonlinear dependence on the frequency k in both these operators. And so the question is, what can you prove about continuity and coercivity? So in this joint paper with Dominguez and Smishleev, we managed to prove these results. So there's a hidden constant here which is independent of k. So the continuity is essentially the L2, a bound on the L2 norm of Rk. And the result is that it grows at worst with k to the 1/3. But this result is only on the circle and uses Fourier analysis. So if you want to work with general smooth boundaries, then you can extend this estimate. But the k to the 1/3 goes to k to the 1/2. And recently with Simon, so that's, I guess, something we did since this program began, we've shown that this k to the 1/2 estimate is sharp in a certain sense. So that means that we expect a growth coming from the continuity of k to the 1/2. And we need to deal with that in the approximation theory for the method.
Sharp in the sense that it couldn't be improved?
In the sense that there's an example for which the norm of Rk grows greater than or equal to k to the 1/2. There's an example of a special boundary.
Smooth or with scalars?
Smooth, yeah.
Convex?
It doesn't have to be convex.
There is an example.
Yeah. The result is that if the boundary contains a straight line segment of a certain length, then you construct a special function which which gives you the estimate.
And if it is trapping? And if it is trapping, it doesn't. If it is not convex, then right?
I don't think these results require convexity. I have to look. Okay, and this is somehow easier. The problem of coercivity is more difficult. So the problem of coercivity is kind of showing inverse boundedness plus more, because it's inverse boundedness in the context of the variational problem. Coercivity, well, the various formulations. So here we take the real part of the inner product, RK, XI, XI, in the L2 inner product. And the result, which is, to me, was completely amazing, very unexpected, was that the coercivity constant is bounded below by 1/2, independent of K. Now, it's actually a topic of great interest at the moment to get this proof working in more complicated geometrical situations. But the proof of this uses Fourier analysis in a serious way. And therefore, actually, it's restricted to, in 2D, the circle, and in higher dimensions, this n-dimensional sphere. But why is this somehow, there's some hope that this can be extended? Well, recent result of Chander, Wild, and Monk showed that the inverse of RK is bounded independently of K. And so this is a result, would be a consequence. I mean, it's a weaker result than this, but it's for general boundaries. Well, it's for star-shaped obstacles in 2D and 3D. So there's a good hope that this can be extended to general boundaries. Okay, so just briefly tell you how the proof goes, even though it's only for the circle. It's reasonably difficult, reasonably technical. So you take polar coordinates on the circle and you write, and that means that the integral operator is pure convolution. So when you look at the kernel, it just depends on the difference. And that means that you can write the integral operator as a classical pseudo-differential operator in Fourier space. And the symbol comes out here to be this combination of Hankel functions and Bessel functions. Okay, so the J primed here comes from the double layer potential, and the J comes from the single layer potential. And you'll see that there's a single linear factor of K, and this linear factor of K comes out by choosing the coupling parameter eta to be equal to K, which is somehow the motivation for that choice, because it balances the K dependence of each of the two potentials. And then if you look at the real part, then it's just this combination of Bessel functions, J and Y. And you see that it's even in M, depends only on mod M. And so the coercivity is ensured if, for all positive m, there is a sufficiently large k, so that this symbol here can be bounded from below in the appropriate way. So the symbol greater than or equal to 1/2 is the result. So that's this. And the way the proof goes is that you consider this inequality and two other inequalities which are sufficient for this. So you get Abramovich and Stegen, and you spend a while with the formulae, and you come to two other, not equivalent, but these two inequalities are sufficient to ensure this. And the way the proof goes is that it consists of three parts in which each of these three conditions is used in a different way. So the first, the criterion two, and this gives you some estimate. This gives you a mu. So the problem is that here's K, the wave number, here's the Fourier mode, and you want to find some line along horizontal line above which everything is bounded in the correct way. So the first estimate says that you can find a mu such that for all Fourier modes bigger than or equal to mu, and all k less than or equal to m, so that's less, so that's below the red diagonal line, everything is correct. And this uses the delicate Debye asymptotics for the Bessel functions just below this red line. Above the red line, you can find a kappa, so that when m is, so when k is greater than or equal to m is greater than or equal to kappa, so that's this hashed region here going up to infinity, everything works. And this uses the criterion 3, which is a criterion on the derivative, the modulus of the derivative of this Hankel function. And you write down Bessel's differential equation for this quantity and fiddle around with that to get the required estimate. And finally, that means that there's only a bounded number of modes which remain in this region. And for those modes, it's sort of a relatively easy argument based on the first criterion. Gives you a threshold for each particular Fourier mode. There's a threshold kappa m, which depends on the Fourier mode m. So there's some kappa m depending on m, so m is going along here. So there's some starting point for each m, which might be different. But because there's only a finite number of these, then there is some straight line that you can draw across here, above which everything works. And that's the proof of coercivity. So there's somehow we've taken care, as best we can, of the asymptotic constant in the error estimate. And now we need to do the approximation theory for the solution.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of Bessel and Hankel functions, and one has to execute special care to provide some uniform asymptotics for Bessel and Hankel with respect to both high k and arbitrary value of the index, right? Which comes from Fourier analysis, but it's sort of related to the subtleties in uniform asymptotics and always result in everything.
Yeah. Those of us who are old enough will remember, and anybody who worked in integral equations in the 80s will remember that there was loads and loads of papers proving stability of numerical methods for integral equations using Fourier analysis. And this is the same sort of thing, but the trick, the complication here is that you have the wave number as well. So you have the two parameters to deal with. Okay, so now, here we have the incident plane wave, here's the obstacle, and now what are we going to do about the oscillations? So the geometric optics approximation says that, so here's the, this is the normal derivative of the total wave, sometimes called the surface current, and you write it as an explicit oscillatory factor times what's hopefully a better behaved function. The explicit oscillating factor in the geometric optics approximation is the normal derivative of the incident wave. So the incident wave is e to the ik x dot d hat, and this is the normal derivative. So here gamma is arc length parameterization. Now we're living on the boundary. And then there are four zones which the boundary is divided up into, illuminated, shadow, and transition zones, sometimes called the Fock domains. And the idea is to use the Galerkin approximation based on this decomposition. And so for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to put, so I'm using explicit oscillations times polynomials. And I'm going to take degree polynomial di in the illuminated zone, degree polynomial dt in each of the two transition zones. And I'm actually going to put zero in the shadow zone. And the reason for that is that in the shadow zone, we have exponential decay, as I'll show you. So actually, this can be extended to a polynomial approximation in the shadow zone quite easily. So after factoring out the geometric optics approximation, we have a polynomial approximation of degree dj in each zone. The delicate parts now, if we say that these polynomials these polynomials are going to be used to approximate the slowly varying, or hopefully more slowly varying, v, then we need the estimates for the derivatives of v in order to do the numerical analysis. And quite delicate is to choose the boundaries, which I can't spell, between the zones. Okay, so for the numerical analyst, the difficult part is then finding the appropriate results in the literature and converting them in a way that make them useful for numerical analysis. So in this work, it's absolutely crucial to have an asymptotics person to guide you. Otherwise, we would have had very little chance to work through this this field, at least in the time available. So this is a theorem which also appeared more or less in Valeri's talk about the slow variable capital V. Okay, so this is an asymptotic series in the sense that the remainder can be controlled by taking L and M. The remainder can be controlled in negative powers of K by taking L and M sufficiently large. Okay, but in the sense that's often been talked about here, you don't have convergence in the numerical analysis sense as L and M go to infinity necessarily. Okay, so the ingredients of this, so here there are functions BLM. These are not known explicitly, but they're known to be smooth and 2 pi periodic. So these are benign functions. Psi is a known function defined as a contour integral. It's known in its entire, and it has known asymptotics. In particular, as x goes to infinity, then psi of x grows slowly, linearly with x. And then as you start differentiating, you start getting negative powers of 1 plus x as x goes to infinity. And z is unknown, but its properties are simple. It's smooth, and it has simple zeros at t1 and t2. It's positive in the illuminated part and negative in the shadow part. So in the sense of asymptotic expansions, you have estimates for the remainder. And the estimates are what you expect. The remainder goes to zero as k goes to infinity with the speed at least as fast as the slowest of the terms that are thrown away when you truncate the series. So if you fix L and M, then you get some decay depending on how big L and M are. Okay, and then there's also an N on 3 here. And the N on 3 is coming from the nth derivative. So every time you differentiate, you generate a growth of k to the one of order k to the 1/3. You can sort of see that by just taking the chain rule on this function here, and every time you differentiate, out pops a k to the 1/3. So roughly speaking, that's where that n on 3 comes from. So if you just look at the first term, just to get a feel for what's happening, here's the first term, L and M equals 0. We have this, and then remembering that psi of x has a 1 plus x growth as x goes to infinity. So why are we looking at x goes to infinity? Well, in the illuminated zone near the tangent, so t1 is the first tangency point. So I'm here, t1, so the here's the incident direction. And I'm looking in this sort of region here. And that means that the function of psi, I'm in this region here. So the function z is positive in this region. So that means that this argument here goes to infinity. So the asymptotics of the psi of x as x goes to infinity kick in. And this without any differentiation, the asymptotics go like 1 plus x. So x is k to the 1 third z of s, so you've got 1 plus k to the 1 third z of s. And so when s gets, so z of s vanishes at the at this tangency point, and so near the tangency point, this z of s would just be equivalent to the distance of s from t1. So what you get is 1 plus k to the 1 third times this distance. And when you start differentiating, you start getting negative powers of this because of the asymptotics of psi that we had in the previous. What happened there?
Incident wave. Oh, good.
I think the power was switched off. Sorry. That's embarrassing. Just take a minute. I plugged my laptop into the PowerPoint here, but it wasn't switched on. So, how's the time? Okay. So, any questions?
Microsoft Vista just released this request.
Now, if I used Microsoft, you wouldn't have to wait so long.
No, it will crash much faster.
Well, Linux is worth every single penny.
In the meantime, is there any intuitive reason why this k to the one third appears?
Well, not intuitive to, I suppose, wasn't intuitive to me when I first started to work in this area, but the K, it's sort of a well-known and well-established fact that in the vicinity of the tangent points, there's a boundary layer of width K to the minus one-third, in which if you take the geometric optics approximation, it's a good approximation outside that boundary layer and not in that boundary layer. And the k to the minus one-third is known in that way. I mean, another way to look at it is if you take the difference between the geometric optics approximation and the known asymptotics towards the tangency point, there's a sort of x to the x cubed term which is missing. If you let the geometric optics approximation go into the tangency point, there's an x cubed term which is missing, and then you invert that and you get a k to the minus one third, in some sense. Do you want to say anything more?
I guess you said it.
Okay.
Precisely.
Oh, thank you.
Right, so basically, as Ivan said, the reason being that near this point, right, the field changes at the scale. Even after you have taken out this rapidly oscillating factor, EIKS, the remainder is still very set scale, k minus one-third near the boundary point.
If the curvature vanishes in your transition points, you'd have a different experience.
There's a question of the curvature.
Yes, yes. It's purely geometric reason.
I
guess there is a simple dimensional analysis that you could say.
Yes.
Okay, sorry about the interruption. So now, when you put together these sort of estimates that I had on the previous slide, you can get estimates for the nth derivative of V, which you need in the numerical analysis. So what comes out is that the first two derivatives are bounded independently of K. And then when you go to the higher derivatives, you get some terms that depend on K. And if you look at the worst term, K to the N minus 1 on 3, and then you get negative powers of this 1 plus K to the 1 third Z of S. And remember that you can replace that by a distance when you're near to the tangency point. So what you see then is that if the distance of S, so if you're well in the illuminated part, the distance from the tangency point is bounded below by a positive constant, then you get a constant there times k to the one-third. And these are powers of k to the one-third on the bottom line. There's order j of those, and there's a power of k to the one-third on the top line of order j. And those cancel out, so that in the illuminated part, you have a well-defined, uniformly bounded V as k goes to infinity. So you can approximate that by any numerical method you like and get an error independent of k. But as you go into this boundary layer, so as this distance here goes into zero, then this k to the one-third gets cancelled out by this becoming near zero. And you get no benefit on the bottom line by the high powers. There are no high powers of k on the bottom line because this is zero. Okay, so that means that globally you have estimates for the derivative of v in terms of powers of k, but this is pessimistic. This is sharp at the shadow boundary, but pessimistic away from that. So in the form that I presented it, this result, which we proved, so this is not our result, but this is a result we derived from the asymptotics. And if you want to find a proof of the original asymptotics, then Melrose and Taylor's paper of 1985 is sort of the right place to reference, but maybe not the right place to read about it, as it's a very difficult paper to read. And if you look there, you'll find only the statement for S sufficiently close to the tangency points. And then if you want to have it globally, which we need, you have to use matched asymptotic expansions to get it for all S. So some of the important references from the 60s and 70s. Okay, another thing that comes out is, you remember in the illuminated part, the argument Z of S is positive. In the shadow part, the argument of Z of S is negative, and then what becomes important as k goes to infinity are the asymptotics of this function as this argument goes to minus infinity. In that case, you have some oscillating exponential, and you have an x cubed on 3, e to the minus I x cubed on 3, and then you have another oscillating exponential with a different speed. And the speed of this second oscillating exponential is related to the Airy function zeros. So when you put in, so if you formally put this argument in for x, what you get, so there's another sort of k to the one-third sort of coming out here, this cubed and the k there. What you get is a product of several exponentials. And this one is oscillating with scale k, and this one is oscillating with scale k to the one-third. And this one here, because it turns out that this quantity here is negative, this one is a decaying exponential. So in this, just behind this tangency point, there are some more oscillations that arise, but they get damped exponentially. So in the talk by Olaf Rundberg, we heard about creeping waves, and these are commonly called creeping waves. formally, if you go a bit further into the shadow and you put the distance k to the minus 1/3 plus epsilon, you get the true exponential decay kicking in. So when you go past the boundary layer far enough, then you get exponential decay. And this, there are many papers about this. There are two references there. So coming to the numerical analysis now, we have estimates of the on the derivatives of V. And if you put those estimates in and you think about polynomial approximation, then it's a simple exercise to, so polynomial approximation should go like 1 on d to the n, where d is the degree of the polynomial, if everything was well behaved. And because there's some growth in the derivatives of V, you get some estimate which depends on k. Okay, and so here, what's the epsilon? Epsilon is a parameter which I play with. I take a boundary layer of width k to the minus 1/3 plus epsilon, so a bit bigger than the classical boundary layer k to the minus 1/3. And what comes out is this estimate. And now you see, I'd like 1 on d to the power of n. That would be sort of super algebraic convergence. But in order to achieve that, I need to cancel out this power of k, which means I need to take epsilon equals 1/3. But if I take epsilon equals 1/3, then it means that I'm not letting the boundary of the illuminated part go into the shadow boundary at all, go into the tangency point at all. So we get a good estimate provided you just keep that fixed, keep this point fixed, and not let it go asymptotically in to the tangency point. Of course, if you do that, then you get a problem in the tangency regions themselves. So this is in the transition zones. If I take the epsilon, play with the epsilon in the same way, then I get an estimate that looks like this. So now, in order to remove this k to the epsilon, my choice would be epsilon equals 0. So you get a conflict. If epsilon equals 0, then that's this small as it could be for the transition zones. And then, so what you do is you balance those two errors. And by balancing the errors, you find epsilon equals 1/9 is the best choice. And the final Galerkin error estimate looks like this. So here's the continuity constant, the coercivity constant. K is the scaling, and that's because this normal derivative of the total wave grows with K. So there's no way we get away without some K dependence. You could take the relative error, divide by K, then it would go away. And then you have the three estimates for the polynomial approximation: the shadow, the transition zones, and the illuminated part. And without going through all the detail, when you choose the epsilon equals 1/9, you get estimates that look like this. And putting it all together, the final Galerkin error estimate looks like this. So there's an exponentially small term which doesn't go to zero with the number of degrees of freedom, but goes to zero with k. And then there's this term here. So there's some modest growth with k. We wouldn't care about that if this was equal to 1, because this is sort of exponentially convergent, so that would give us a logarithmic dependence on the degrees of freedom. So the troublesome term is this somehow k to the 1/9. It's maybe not that troublesome. K to the 1/9 is very weak. But roughly speaking, what this says is that if you let the degrees of freedom grow with k to the 1/9, then you preserve the accuracy of the method for all k. Here's a computation on the unit circle. So the real and imaginary parts of the slow variable v. So this is what we compute, and this is the solution. So there are many oscillations. It's not such a good picture, I guess, converted PS to PDF, not using an optimal method. Just looks black. There are many, many oscillations in here. And this is the illuminated part here where the geometric optics approximation works best. So this is what came out of the computer, and this is the solution. And here's the error in the slow variable. And you see it's of order 10 to the minus 4. The number of degrees of freedom is of the order of 60 in this calculation. So it's a very small matrix. There's some delicate choice of the right parameters when you say something is order k to the minus 1/9, then you have to choose some constant, and some optimization of the constants took place to get the best behavior in these transition zones. Okay, numerical results. So as k increases, you actually see, so the theory says there may be some growth as k increases. But actually you see, in this example, you see improvement as k increases, very modest improvement. For fixed k, as the number of degrees of freedom, so the degrees of freedom is 3 times this plus 3, so 63 in this case. So as you go down this column, for example, you get some convergence, and then it levels off, and that's because of the exponentially small factor, which isn't zero. So for this, for example, for this case, here we have 63 degrees of freedom, an error of 10 to the minus 5. If you used a conventional method, you'd need of the order of 8,000 degrees of freedom. If you do non-circular geometries, then the improvement across these horizontal lines doesn't seem to persist. What you see is more or less constant error without growth, but not getting actually better with k. So there's an ellipse, and there's the error. In the case of non-smooth, so everything I've said was for smooth convex obstacles. And you can do the same method in 3D for smooth convex obstacles, taking out the geometric optics approximation. The numerical analysis would be considerably more complicated in 3D. There's recent work which some people will have seen by Simon and Steve Langdon on convex polygons, where here you don't, so it's, this problem is both harder and easier. It's harder because the non-smooth boundaries, the corners produce diffractions, which have a substantial impact on the field. On the other hand, there's no tangency points, so this delicate business of the k to the minus 1/3 doesn't arise. So they managed to prove, using very much hands-on arguments using integral equations, the appropriate results on the regularity of the solution. But what they don't have is the coercivity estimate for the non-smooth boundary. But they have all of the nice approximation theory. So finally, I just wanted to mention what we're doing with the oscillatory integration, because the pure Galerkin method involves the variational form of the equation and integrated exactly. And so what we're doing in this analysis is showing that you can handle the high k in terms of the integral operator and in terms of the approximation, but we're leaving out the problem of implementation. So far we didn't include the cost of computing the matrix, and the error analysis involved in errors in the matrix feeding into errors in the numerical solution. Okay, well, that can be done. Once you have a Galerkin method, then you can use the Strang lemma to estimate the error in the numerical solution in terms of errors in the matrix. You have to control the errors in the matrix. So this is the approach that we've taken, which is slightly different but related to things that I've heard since I've been in the program. So here's a typical Galerkin entry. So there's the Hankel function kernel, and then there's the modulation. So remember that the basis functions themselves introduce an oscillatory behavior, and because they're double integrals, there's a y minus x oscillatory behavior So here is the direction of the incident wave. And then you can gather up the phase of the of this product, and it's just this. The distance between x and y plus d hat y minus x. And then there is an oscillatory, non-oscillatory, well-behaved term. And we have double integrals. So if, for illustration, we consider only the illuminated part, and let's call that AB, and then we have a singularity in MK at x equals y. So let's just avoid that singularity and go from S to B. We could also go from A to S in the same way. Then we have this integral to do with this given phase. And in this case, a geometric argument shows there are no stationary points, in the sense of, for fixed S, as t varies, there's no stationary point with respect to t. So we took a very simple-minded idea, and actually this really is an idea of Marcus Melink, who's been working on the polygon case. So the idea is to introduce a change of variable, and I'm going to rewrite this double integral as a single integral for a function f, which itself is defined as an integral. And then I'm going to use a composite Phylon rule on a mesh with respect to tau. And what I like about that is that if I use a Phylon rule on a mesh, then I have a step length in the mesh. The Phylon rule kind of takes care of this oscillatory kernel. And then I'll get an estimate which, well, it might not go to zero as k goes to infinity, or it might go quite modestly to zero as k goes to infinity, but I will have a parameter, a mesh parameter, that I can tune to make the error sufficiently small. So just to finish, then, so I make this change of variable, tau equals this function. I have and then I have to be able to invert, so psi sub s is this function. For fixed s, this function of t. So I make this change of variable in the inside. And then I get a Jacobian which depends on the inverse of this of psi s. So we need a Newton-like method for evaluating this inverse. And when we put that in and change the variable, what comes out is an integral over this region. So unfortunately, in the case of curvilinear curve boundaries, in the case of polygons, this is a straight line. But in the case of curve boundaries, this is not monotone. So you get an integral of this form over this region. And then when you change the order of integration, you get exactly the right thing in the form that you want to use it for Phylon's rule. But the evaluation of f of tau involves integrating from this blue. For each d, you have to integrate with respect to s between these two curves. And there's a turning point up at the top here. But that can be done. And so what we did was we applied a Phylon rule to evaluate this integral. In fact, Clenshaw-Curtis rule on a graded mesh. Piecewise applied Clenshaw-Curtis Phylon rule on a graded mesh. There are various singularities. So the kernel singularity, the weakly singular nature of the kernel is inherited along this line. There's also a singularity up here from the turning point. But these can be analyzed. Each evaluation of f of tau is done by a Gauss rule. And we can then I expect that we can prove k explicit error estimates as the mesh is refined. And there's this sort of test example where k increases. The CPU time is very modestly almost not growing. This is seconds for a for one integral. And the relative error is staying stable. It sort of gets better, gets slightly worse, but certainly stays in a reasonable size compared to the error in the numerical method. And the error analysis is work in progress. These are the grid points which we use. And the point about this is that this is k independent. So you need a grid in this complicated region, and then it works for all k. Okay, so finally, These are the areas that we're interested in working in. Extending the coercivity to general boundaries, some discussion ongoing at the moment. 3D implementations. K-explicit error estimates for oscillatory integrals, in particular for the Galerkin method. Errors due to boundary approximation, multiple scattering, and fast linear algebra. Okay, that's all.
Right, we have time for questions.
Are your Galerkin systems badly conditioned, the matrices?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's an open question, they're ill-conditioned, but at least, the purpose of this method is to produce a very small system to approximate the problem with the only oscillations. So at the present time, you wouldn't use anything other than direct solvers for the size of systems that we have to work with. So there's no sort of question about iterative methods. But when you go to more complicated 3D problems, it's certainly going to be important how the conditioning of the matrix is, and preconditioning and all that will be an interesting problem.
How much would change in your error analysis if the continuity constant, if you choose one like square root of k instead of k to a third?
Well, it doesn't. Hardly changes at all. What you would do, what you'd get is an extra k to the 1/6 on the right hand side.
Would there be a problem in the method if one part of the obstacle is in fact straight?
Yeah, there's nothing to stop that. We haven't assumed analyticity for the contour, so C infinity in 2D at least. So I think it would still work. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so if I might go to the last few slides.
Okay.
So essentially, after you change the variable, mm-hmm. you introduce the Jacobian and so on, so you have an exponential oscillator times something which is weakly singular.
Yeah.
Now, weak singularity is essentially equivalent to stationary points. And so my feeling is that actually you don't need the grid at all. What you need is essentially to evaluate the function at the stationary, consider the weak singularities as stationary points, evaluate the function there, evaluate it at a few points on the boundary and so on, and interpolate it. And then you'll have a proper Filon method, or probably a proper Levine method.
Well, weak singularity means it's infinite.
Weak singularity, okay, suppose that your weak singularity is, say, 1 over square root of x minus 1. So you have a function over square root, keep the square root, you don't interpolate, of course, 1 over square root. Now, provided you can evaluate the explicit contribution of the square root, you can extract it out. So in one dimension, it is very easy to see. Mm-hmm. Actually, in one dimension, you can even do the Cauchy integral of 1 over x minus y. So actually, quite a strong singularity. And you can do it this way.
Yeah, I suppose that...
You can dispose of the grid altogether.
Well, I'm not sure that you can dispose of it, because we do want methods that work for a range of values of k, not just sufficiently large k. So I'm not sure you can dispose of the grid, but maybe we can do something better than what we're doing.
Well, the stored range of values of k is that...
Yeah.
Say, Filon or Levine method. For very small k, they sort of collapse into Gaussian quadrature. And this is, by the way, exactly what you see in your... So the worst range is in the middle.
Yeah. That's
which
true.
Is exactly in your, what happens in your table. So if you start with 10 to minus 8, then go to 10 minus 5, and then it again goes down for the large k. But this will happen as a matter of course for Froom and Levine methods.
But what bothers me is how that feeds into explicit error estimate. So you have an explicit error estimate for your Galerkin method, and then you have some perturbation coming from the quadrature. And whereas I appreciate what you're saying about what actually happens, I don't know what the error estimate will look like. Mm. I mean, I don't know anything other than something that goes like 1 over k to some power. And I think we need something different. We would love to have 1 over k to some power, but we also need a parameter which you can say you must take enough of something. Grid points, for example.
But you have that from, because it's just polynomial interpolation, so you know it's, the error is less than the polynomial interpolation.
Well, maybe you have something that I don't know about, but I didn't see so far this sort of estimate.
No, the estimate, actually, it is precisely of the same form as you have, say, in Lax-Milgram theorem for finite elements, because it is some constant, which is nothing to do with coercivity, boundedness, but a constant times the error in polynomial approximation.
Well, that's more or less what we need. So,
and the issue of how this constant may depend on k, right?
No, the constant will be fairly independent.
It'll be better than polynomial interpolation, because polynomial interpolation will give you a bound, but then the actual error decays as k increases. Mm-hmm. So that error will give you a bound to the error, which is O of 1, while the actual error is much less than the bound, but it still gives you a bound.
Well, I would be interested to see where these results are written down, because I didn't see them so far. But I'm sure that that's in the right direction.
Question, the K 1 over 9, is this completely arbitrary, or where do you get it from?
Well, it came from, we had two contributions to the error, essentially, in terms of approximation theory. So I'm thinking about approximating the slowly varying part of the solution, capital V. And there are two contributions, one from the approximation in these blue transition zones, and one from the approximation in the red illuminated zone. And there's a conflict between those two errors. And the way that there's a parameter which you have to choose to balance those errors. When you choose that parameter in the optimal way, you get k to the 1/9. But there's no. I don't expect that this k to the 1/9 is there. I mean, I expect that there should be a better argument to remove it.
I'll explain it to myself. K to the power 1/9 is k to 1/3 to the power 1/3, right? Difficult to argue. So there is something which is, gives you power k 1/3 within this area, and but as I haven't explained, by optimizing and matching it to the nicer area of geometrical optics, you can sort of square it in a sense, right?
So there's an argument.
That's very way. Okay, so we've decided the question. Thank you again.